I could listen to that all day. John Coltrane with Blue Train, the title track of his 1957 album, which also features a collection of some of the finest musicians here, as sidemen, Curtis Fuller on trombone, Kenny Drew on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums. Of course, this tune was written by Coltrane himself. It is considered a jazz classic, as is almost everything that he has written. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. We're going for broke today. We're going to tie this thing up today and dispense with it. That means that we're returning to yesterday's program, the theme of it, continuing the discussion on the what should I say, the symbolism, the importance, the significance of President George Herbert Walker Bush, who died, as you know, last Friday at his home in Houston, Texas, after years of battle against Parkinson's disease and related complications. President Bush was the head of state from 1981 to 1989. Oh, sorry, he was vice president from 1981 to 1989, and president from 1989 to 1993. We're going to just have our discussion today and then we're moving on. The reason we're having a follow-up to yesterday is I really, to be truthful, I felt a little bit disappointed, because we really have to get into the habit of respecting what we know. I've talked about it all the time. Trust what you know. And most of us listening to the program today have been through the George H.W. Bush era, and it did affect us in one way or another, except perhaps we decided to block it out. But it is important. And it is important that we ourselves define the moment, define that pocket of history. Because we lived it. We were there. There are things we remember. And the tendency, I want us to get out of the tendency of relying on other people to define our history, a history that we know. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that you throw out all of your history books, but I'm saying trust that in each of us there is something to be gained and learned from actual experience. And we do have a right to occupy intellectual space. And so when the opportunity arises, as is the case now, in assessing George H.W. Bush's tenure, either as vice president or president, we should be comfortable with the idea that we can define that ourselves. We're not in the business of bashing. We're just stating what we remember and what we recall as the reality at the time, how we experienced that reality. And therefore, each of us is in a position to offer a comment, to offer an analysis. We're not professional historians, and yet We are the kind of historians that historians try like crazy to find. You know, you read stories about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Okay. Facts are presented, pictures and accounts and so forth are gathered up and presented in all kinds of forms. But nothing is as profound. Nothing is as profound as hearing how people experienced that act of annihilating Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They're ordinary people. And it is the case in all historical events. The historians will write about events as they interpret them, as they interpret facts that they gather about these events. But nothing is as profound to me, and that is great history. Nothing is as profound as having people guide us through that experience from their own vantage point. There's no right or wrong, but it's important that we appreciate that this is the actual experience of a person in the moment that a thing happened, or even in retrospect. That's why I like historians like Ivan van Sertima and Jan Carew. Of course, like any historian, they will do research and gather facts. But there is nothing as profound as when van Sertima presents, let's say, Christopher Columbus in Columbus's own words, from his letters, from his statements, his actual statements. And to get at that, he had to go through all kinds of contortions to obtain these documents. But they are, in fact, Christopher Columbus in his own words, explaining the reality that he's experiencing. Of course, lots and lots of questions about it. And then, you know, that's the other side of history, to test the veracity of things. But when you hear from an original source how an event was actually experienced, how it impacted millions and millions of people, and you're getting one window into that event, that is an extraordinary thing. So this is where we want to go again today. We came through the era of George H.W. Bush, president from 1989 to 1993, vice president from 1981 to 1989. I find it hard to believe that no one could actually recall the experience, the actual experience of George H.W. Bush for those years. And that's what I want to encourage you to do today. Because that is the history, it's an authentic history. Because you're telling us, it's one, you know, you're linking cause and effect. You're giving us a reality that we don't normally get. We have to go read textbooks and they, you know, it's cut and dried, and this happened on this day, and this is what happened on that day. That's one kind of history. But imagine getting the actual history from, say, somebody in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who actually lived through the experience of being bombed as an American citizen by the American government and the city leveled. You can't beat that. You can't. So, in revisiting the subject, and then we close it out, we don't want to be stuck in George H.W. Bush forever. He's already gone on his way. And life is going on for his family, which remains secure in ways that we are not. They have wealth, generational wealth. They have social standing. They're able to make real anything practically that they can imagine that they want to do. They can do that. They have status. And it is a very interesting contrast, don't you think? Between that kind of wealth and the wealth of the current president, he just has a bit of money, but it's not the kind of money as George H.W. Bush had. George H.W. Bush came out of a dynastic family. Politically and socially. This current president, was created in terms of wealth just a blink of an eye ago. So there are raw differences between the two. All right, so let's get started with this thing. I want you to get comfortable, really, get very comfortable with the idea that your experiences have merit and value, and we should appreciate what it is you went through. Other people experienced this leader in a different way. What was that way? How did this man, who is to be buried, I think Thursday, after a day of mourning tomorrow, what was his impact in our lives, collectively and individually? How did he affect our reality on a day-to-day basis? What do we recall of that? These things have value. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And let's get this conversation started. Let's get a different kind of history related. And I know it's out there because I know people experienced this president. And, as I said, it's the intention here is not to cut anybody up and chop him down. The idea is to dispassionately, and even if you wish to passionately analyze what you recall of those years and how you came through those years. What was the impact on you? Jay from New York, you're getting us started today.
Yes, good afternoon, Nutrice. I hope all is well. I
Me
think
too.
the
I
first
hope all is
thing
well with you.
it is. I think the first thing that comes to mind when thinking of George W.H. Bush is the
HW.
criminalization, HW or whatever W it is the criminalization of black men through Willie Horton, the young brother that they basically coerced into selling drugs that wound up doing a long prison sentence, which led to once Bush was defeated, Clinton and Biden and the rest of them did the whole criminalization of more black men and other minorities Then you could think of Clarence Thomas and how someone who was totally unqualified to become a Supreme Court justice was able to become a Supreme Court justice. Then you could just talk about his whole actions as a CIA individual with things he did here and abroad that caused great problems even to this day.
You've recited three important things. But what of the responsibility I want you to assume now is to tell us how these things registered on you. How did you experience these things?
Well, I experienced number one with the Willie Horton was how, as a young black man, I was perceived. How they used that to keep other black men from getting opportunities. How they used it to incarcerate more black men. It was just basically a perception that most black men were criminals and that most people who were incarcerated could not be rehabilitated. So that affected not only me, but my community, because we wasn't given the opportunities to improve our lives because of a perception by the broader society. Then when you look at Clarence Thomas, you could look at how the relationship with black men and black women was affected because of Anita Hill and how that whole thing played out. And then also
What was the whole thing? What was the whole thing? Don't just
leave it out there hanging.
Tell us fully what that meant and why you selected as being significant.
Well, it meant that black women were lying about being sexually harassed, that you could not believe a black woman's story, that it pitted men and women against one another that basically had nothing to do with it other than being black and white, that here it is, there were strong black men who were defending Anita Hill, and then there was conservative black men who were defending Clarence Thomas, and that, you know, basically white people were dictating how the process was being presented, and, you know, they just pushed it forward. And that, you know, you had, you know, people like I think it was, his name is passing me by, her lawyer, Charles Ogletree, you know, that was, you know, pitted against other attorneys, and he was seen in a certain way, which thankfully he was, after that, allowed to have a very nice statue in America as a attorney for black people. So, I mean, it caused problems in regards to relationships between black people in the community, because some people were so happy that he was getting the opportunity, and then there was others who was against him getting the opportunity because of, you know, the manner in which he treated Anita Hill, and they believed that he was guilty. So that was something that affected the community because it divided us in a sense. So those are things that when you sit back and you look at it and you look at the behavior in the history of Clarence Thomas, most people today that didn't believe Anita Hill would believe her now because of the history of his actions, which
you have a parallel now with the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court.
But if you notice, that was handled differently. That wasn't handled in the same fashion that it was with Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. I don't think it fractured the white community in the manner in which Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas fractured the black community and pitted each other against one another. I don't feel that way. I feel it caused the great strain on us.
What I'm saying is, though, that consider the time. You know, years have passed between the appointment of Clarence Thomas and the whole debacle concerning Kavanaugh. So,
yeah, but Thomas is a polarizing figure. Thomas is someone that then caused a lot of problems within our community. Kavanaugh, on another level, may cause problems, but, you know, he didn't pulverize the community in the manner in which Clarence Thomas had. And that's something that George Bush gave us. You know what I mean? Remember, Clarence Thomas didn't even have the necessary experience to even be placed on the court. And no one talks about that.
Lacked the experience. Here's the thing. Your point is made, but you also, I think, missing the point that it isn't when it comes down to it, it isn't so much that a person, Clarence Thomas or Brett Kavanaugh, as prospective U.S. Supreme Court justices, they themselves caused anything. It was really the way it was handled and what the intention might have been from the beginning. The intention by George Bush, George H.W. Bush, was to present a liberalism that had not really been associated with the party at the time, the Republican Party. Just as the appointment by Kavanaugh, by a president who has business interests ahead of social issues and legal issues, resulted in Trump pushing for Kavanaugh because he saw Kavanaugh as a presence on the U.S. Supreme Court that would protect big business and ultimately himself. But thank you so much for getting us started, Jay. Good points, and thank you for them. Thank you so much. Joe from New Jersey, you're on the air, and the number to call is 888-874-4888. Joe, you're on the air.
Now I hear you really well.
Okay, good.
First, I love your work. I've always loved your work, and I enjoy it to this day. I don't know if you remember me. I've called twice before.
Yes, I remember you.
I called today because I remembered yesterday a moment when I saw George Bush Sr. for the first time on television as president. I don't recall exactly what he was doing or talking about, but I remember in contrast to Ronald Reagan, he seemed cold, calculated, and extraordinarily effective. Not as great a speaker. He was much more obviously managing some situation, and it was like, oh my gosh, now we've got somebody who can work this stuff, and he's not hiding his deep connection to the system that he was about to be operating.
Okay. Why did this particular aspect strike you?
I thought that a lot of things were going to happen in a very drastic way, much more so today, but at the time it was as big a contrast as what we have now.
You had trepidation? Did it indicate that the incoming president was going to be about a different agenda than you ever imagined? Did it strike concern or fear in your heart? Did you feel
the openness? And I had just come back from California, so I recall Dennis Bernstein's program, Ronald Reagan and the Prophecy of Armageddon, and a series of shows called the Contragate Highlights, Contragate Follies. And it just really worried me about what had already happened while he was vice president. And knowing that he was now in charge really, really scared me about our place in the world and how radically this could change our safety and our position.
Could you cite an example or a couple of examples of what instilled a sense of trepidation and which turned out to be well placed?
I've just heard stuff about the pardons that were involved around the Iran-Contra hearings, and some of these things were being talked about at the time, but the Gulf War was a series of manipulations that I had heard began with the okey-doke for drilling into Iraq's territory sideways from Kuwait, and then demanding protection and not getting it. Some ridiculous turns of events in the world's politics that allowed for much more instability. I used to think that things were at least being watched over and protected from continued clandestine and secret operations that would jeopardize our right to say we are the place that doesn't do that.
As you look back now, do you believe that the uneasiness, the trepidation that you had about George Bush Senior, were they well placed, or was there something that basically came out of nowhere that surprised you, that was on the positive side?
I believe that as long as money has the power of speech, and other very powerful, unchecked organizations have any control over the part of what makes this country pretty wondrous in a lot of ways, I'm going to keep thinking that you know, a paranoid fantasy would be that the world has betrayed us after all. It's just not that simple. It's just protecting ourselves against a wolf. It involves openness and involvement, and as long as we can't operate safely with good information or enough of it to formulate an idea of our own, we're in danger of not knowing when we're correct. And it's reflected in the way people seem to have difficulty in explaining their thoughts or how they feel. It's horrifying when people refer you to web pages instead of saying what they condensed from, what they learned from this issue that they studied. I'm often worried about that, and I have only a few people that I contact regularly and talk about these things with, and it's harder and harder to believe that some things are getting more difficult that are fundamental to what makes us qualified and right when we express ourselves. It's very scary.
That's very, very deep, actually. Thank you so much for your contribution today, Joe. Thanks for calling in. Ma'at from New York, you're on the air.
Thank you for this opportunity and for the beloved community. Okay, I tell you, boy, George Bush really brings up some type of memories from knowing about his graduation from Yale and lifetime membership in Yale Skull and Bone Secret Society, which is a funnel to the CIA. And so the Eastern Establishment Industrial Finance Energy Capital picks up and corners West Texas and the West with the Zapata Oil Company and the Operation Condor, which were the death squads in Latin America, and everything else regarding the CIA. I mean, I had to relate to when Willie mentioned that George H.W. Bush was the only one or two people who didn't know where they were. He was actually in Dallas as photographed. But one of the things for you, Trees and family, that's not mentioned is how I was affected about the December 89 invasion of Panama. And the horror of that, hearing about a very poor town, city called El Cerrillo. I might not be saying that correctly. And how the civilians and the population was targeted. And, of course, getting back to the CIA, the Noriega connection. There's a documentary I remember at the time called The Panama Deception, which it's just hard to process what happened to those people. And one other point that I made, because finally somebody mentioned...
But hold on. You're giving us a list. The task we have today is to select something and explain it from the perspective of the impact it had on you. So we need fuller information. We need a little bit more complete accounting of the thing that you said that affected you so deeply.
Well, just watching the coverage, seeing that Panama deception, and seeing how devastated that country, Panama, I remember certain parts of that Panama deception. I don't have a full memory, but that was just devastating. And as to the related ties to this, because he was only director for 1 year, I think 76 and 77, but the ties to the CIA is funneled out of the Skull and Bone Secret Society. It just means that there was a Bay of Pigs. There was
but you're throwing things around. What I'm saying is you're throwing things out, but they have no connection to how you experienced the moment. You linking the Skull and Bone Society to CIA activity and so forth. We have no proof of that. There's no proof of it. There's been speculation. There's been even innuendo and accusation about it. But there's no definitive proof of what you say, that it was a kind of ongoing funnel, that the secret society at Yale, the Skull and Bone Society, much has been made of that. We are not in a position to prove anything.
But Trees, I want to take some exception, because one of the books that I was really impressed with is by Chris Mulligan, and he has his publishing company, Trinday. His father was actually a part of the CIA, and at some point, he took his son aside to make him aware, and what he brought forth is documented in that book, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones.
Yes, but it is not the only book it's not the only book about the Skull and Bone Society and this narrative about, you know, the dark side of the intelligence community. I'm asking because you're not affected, I mean, in terms of this exercise, you're not personally affected by the Skull and Bones, but you can tell us about those things that, as you were beginning to tell us about Panama, how did it personally affect you?
Well, so that's I was affected by all of it because it's wickedness, it's dirty tricks, it's war making on people who are don't even have very much and devastating their infrastructure and killing them. And, you know, so I was very affected, especially as I followed that particular town, Chorillo, I believe. I used to know how to pronounce it. Get on it.
Chorillo.
Yeah, I was very affected. And, of course, those of us who study, you know, the so-called dark side of the CIA, we know what they did. In fact, the migrants coming on now, are in 54, they overthrew a democratically elected government of Arbenz, I believe his name was, devastated his family. And, you know, so some of us do study and follow the paths, and there are a lot of books documenting what has
Okay, listen to what I'm asking. All these things exist, but I'm asking for you and others today, which we did not get accomplished yesterday, to zoom in on a particular event or thing that had very deep impact on you. How did you experience that? Give us some background about it. So when we talk about Panama, next we're talking about Skull and Bones, and next we talk about something else. In the end,
so let me give one example of what really affected me was to the gut, as it were. And that is, and black people being fooled too, because putting a so-called black in the place of Thurgood Marshall, and you give us a Clarence Thomas, and you know, I didn't even turn on the hearings with Anita Hill because I knew the way it was going to go. I kind of foresaw how she would be denigrated and not given any credibility. And you know, the black folks who said, well, he's a black guy, they didn't realize that we was about to go down a terrible, terrible path, and I felt that in my gut.
Okay, but what was for you the issue in all of that? What was for you the singular issue?
Well, you have an icon of our human rights movement, because that's what it needs to be called, as opposed to the civil rights movement, you know, who was prominent in the most seminal cases, whether Brown v. Board, et cetera, et cetera. And you replace him with a conservative, and we need to deconstruct that word because, you know, we really, they have no credibility anymore. A lot of them have denounced the fact that they're even conservative anymore, you know, because of what we're seeing presently. But all of it sort of led up to Trump, if you will. You know, he's just part of the continuum when I look at George H.W. Bush.
Okay. Well, you gave us a pretty comprehensive tour. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling in and for contributing. 888-874-4888. We'll take the short break and come back to your remembrances. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're recalling the life, if you will, of George H.W. Bush, who died last Friday and who will be buried on Thursday. And we're looking at his term in office as vice president and as president of the United States in terms of what we recall, singular events that we can recall that were essentially under his purview. And we're recalling these events from a personal perspective as being affected by them. Of course, we're not just individuals, you know, this was not just about an individual being affected, but it gives us a close-up of how we experienced this particular individual. How did he, as a leader, as someone entrusted with leadership at that level, how did he resonate with us? And we're getting different pictures of that. 888-874-4888. Now, it's really interesting, and you look at the coverage that his death has basically generated so far. It's very sympathetic, as we expect it to be. We expect it to be sympathetic, to be very praiseworthy, to be very kind and generous, to be more positive than negative, to uplift him, make him a hero in death. These are the kinds of attitudes that we could expect in media coverage. There will be no serious analysis of it. And in a sense, that is par for the course, right? In the immediate aftermath of somebody's death, you want to recall the best attributes. But then it shifts. It shifts, as it will here on this program as well. Ali from New York, how did
you... Hi, Eutrice. How are you doing?
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Now I could hear you. I thought I got cut off. Okay. This is what I had to say about Bush Senior. I haven't really watched any of the coverage because I'm not interested in really watching any of those things. I have more of the coverage for this on your show since you start doing this and questioning, you know, the audience about what they thought and their experience. So this is the one experience that I actually do remember. Do you remember when Noriega was taken into custody and he was paraded on TV here in the United States? Almost every channel had it, had this man handcuffed, and you saw him almost, you almost look at him, and then you saw his face, and he was somebody, and you look like somebody, he looked like somebody who hasn't really had gotten any sleep, and then he had those handcuffs. That was very, I always remember that. I always remember that impression of him. Also, I believe it was 60 Minutes who did a segment back then when they used to do real journalism, investigating journalism. And one of the things, it was, again, talking about Noriega and talking about what went in Panama. Like I said, that I always remember him being handcuffed and how he looked. But then I also remember how there was the talk about how he was involved in drug dealing. But then back then also, then there was the connection that they were trying to make how Bush Sr. was in the CIA, he was in the CIA, and he was the director of the CIA, and how the contract, they were dealing arms and drugs in Nicaragua, And the connection was there because when I saw him being handcuffed and the way that this man was paraded on the American TV, making the connection that he was a drug dealer, it just came to my head how the CIA also was connected to drug dealer, and how one of their plane in Nicaragua was shot down by the Sandinista, and they denied that the person that they caught, the pilot, worked for the CIA. So when they caught him, I was not surprised the connection of the CIA and how he was caught and how they had killed these people in Panama and how Bush Sr. had sent the troop to supposedly get Noriega, where they knew that they didn't really have to go into Panama and kill all these people because they knew that they could just go in and get him, being that he was working for the CIA anyway in this drug dealer. So that affected me a lot because I always remember him, like I said and I repeated, this is my third time, being paraded on TV and as a black man and as a Latino, as a black woman, as a Latino, it's always the same thing, the brown people being attacked, the brown people being caught into custody and put into jail, especially in this country. So that's how, you know, this whole thing had affected me. And I always remember him. I always remember him.
Do you link, or have you thought about a link between Noriega and the whole issue of cocaine and transportation of drugs and so forth, and a little airport in Arkansas called Mena?
I know that a lot of the drugs was are connected to Arkansas because, you know, as they said, they actually even implicated Bill Clinton in this drug dealing, and how they used the Arkansas airport to bring drugs from South America. So I really don't have like recollection of that, but I do have the recollection of the Sandinista and how this plane was shot down and how the American government denied that the men worked for the CIA, the pilot, and then the Sandinista waited until the denial, and then they show on TV back then how all his documents and now to prove that he was a CIA agent. That I do remember. And this is, you know, all the things you put it together. And even though he was drilling drugs, and I'm not saying, because remember, those drugs that have been brought into this country and it had affected the black and brown people more than any other group, even though the other group, the Caucasian, they use as much drug or even more that brown and black people in this country. So, and in the war on drugs, the discrimination against us and all the, like your first caller said, he remembered, you know, as a black man, this is something that it has affected a lot of the black men in this country. So, but I do put the connection of the CIA. And remember, the CIA has been known for being involved in the country, and that's why that man, I forgot his name, Webb, he committed suicide because he, all these things, they lied about it, they denied about it, and then later on was proven that the CIA was involved in the transportation of all these drugs. And I wouldn't be surprised that at that time that Noriega was involved on all that transportation of the drugs. But again, even though if he was guilty, the people from the country, all of them got out. All of them were pardoned by Bush Sr. So
how did that affect you when other Bushes surfaced in positions of authority? You had George W. Bush, president. You had Jeb Bush, governor of Florida. Did you make any links between the father and the sons?
I make connection on all of them because, you know, it's a dynasty. Remember, like you explained it at the beginning of the show. These people, I mean, you were comparing him, that dynasty against Trump and how they came into money. These people, when I connect all of them together, it's the same thing. The first thing that you see, and I'm on all of them, is money. It's not about them being smart, getting into school and being smart, but it's about money. It's about power. It's about the social class that you would never, none of us would be able to ever get in. And so when you put it together, it's people with power. And even though he's dead, I mean, his offspring is out there. I mean, he has his two sons that is, you still see them. And now look at W, how people, they think that now comparing to Trump, people think that he's such a nice guy. I mean, the Obama, embracing each other.
They're having a love affair.
Yes, yes. So the whole thing is just, it's really bad. But I just wanted to add this, that this is some of the thing. Back then when Noriega got arrested, I wasn't so much into history because, you know, I went to most of the high school in here. They don't really teach you history. So then you wanted to learn more and more. And then when I went to the community school, I met one of those independentista for a Puerto Rican professor. And then they start telling you, and then you wanted to learn more and more. And that's when you realize how this government, they have gone into so many, especially black and brown country, and they have done so much damage. And even into white population, which is the Argentina and the Chilean, they consider themselves white, and how much damage they have done into Latin America. So that's one of the things. Every time that I think about Noriega and how he was handcuffed and how he was portrayed and the lights that they were shining into his face so people could really see this so-called drug dealer, you actually wanted to learn more about history, especially history, not so much European history, but your own history here in Latin America and what had happened to every country in Latin America.
Thank you so much, Ali, for calling and contributing today. And that brings us to the end of our program, but not the end of our search for truth. And very often, we would find that we overlook things that should, you know, rattle our intuition about things. You just know that what you're looking at is wrong. You know that you feel that policies are wrong, and they turn out exactly to be that. They're wrong. But we have to trust ourselves that history is not just given to us. It's not just written for us. Much of it is. But a lot of it has to do with us paying attention to the stories we know, the things that we know, and questioning. And we can trust ourselves. Like I said, if I had a choice as a historian of writing about Hiroshima and Nagasaki from the point of view of bureaucrats, or listening to how people actually on the ground experienced these horrific events, there's no hesitation about which way I will go, because they will tell you the truth. They'll tell you exactly what happened in their own words. Thanks so much for listening today, and we'll join each other tomorrow again. Thanks for contributing as well. Bye-bye.